Part 4. McCoy calls Kirk before he calls the police. He can't remember what he says, but Kirk finds him in a blood-spattered room on the third floor. The display on his cell phone reveals only 4 minutes have passed from the time he put the call through to Kirk dropping down on his knees next to McCoy and pulling him firmly against his chest. McCoy curls into Kirk easily, lets Kirk's hands dig into McCoy's neck and head to keep him as close to the pounding chest as possible. He smells like cigarette smoke and gin, and McCoy nearly rattles apart under the familiar smells saturating his body. "Everyone," McCoy tries to say, squeezes his eyes shut. He can't get their faces out of his head, the rooms he ran into, the single bullet in the center of everyone's foreheads, the halo of blood around their heads that stained their pillows and seeped through the mattress to spill, drip, like percolated coffee on the floor. The police and first response arrive only once Kirk gotten McCoy out of the hospital, wrapped his Columbia U sweatshirt around McCoy's shoulders, and sits next to him when Police Captain Pike asks him question after question. Kirk's only wearing a black undershirt, lets Pike see the stars he covers up like the dirty little secret they are. Kirk doesn't even care. He cuts Pike's line of questioning off when McCoy starts to shake, tells Pike that he's going to take McCoy home and they'll resume later tonight. Pike takes a hard look at McCoy's face. McCoy can't stop shaking. Feels like he did the first time he went to New York and got caught in a blizzard. He feels Kirk's arm tighten around him, his lips soft against his temple. Kirk's usually an inferno of heat, but McCoy can barely feel him. Pike lets them leave. Looks at Kirk like it's the first time he's seeing him. Kirk tightens his arm around McCoy, challenges Pike with a low blue glare. Pike sighs, claps him on his bare shoulder. "I'll come by later," Pike says. "Watch him like a hawk." "I do," Kirk replies instantly. "Challenging." Sulu manages to drive them 2 blocks before McCoy makes a mad scramble for the door handle, as Kirk's broad palm holds his forehead as he vomits into the street. Kirk brings him straight to bed, climbs in next to him. Uhura comes in, right when the sun is at its highest, and gingerly sits on the bed, hands McCoy a warm mug filled with something that smells like mint and rose petals. "Drink it," she encourages, smooths her hand across his brow. When he does, he feels woozy, heavy. His eyes slide shut, and Kirk pulls him down and back to his broad chest. When McCoy wakes up, it's 9 p.m., and Kirk is still snug behind him. Pike is one of the few people in the city who are generally weary of Kirk and his extracurricular activities. He knew Kirk's father, was a pallbearer at the funeral, and is the only law official Kirk has ever let into his house. He's sitting at the kitchen table, writes down everything McCoy says without looking at his notepad, keeps up a steady eye contact that soothes McCoy, helps chase away some of the mangled corpses that used to be his patients, his friends. Kirk sits at the opposite end of Pike, arms crossed, face impassive. He pipes in occasionally, reminds McCoy that he doesn't have to answer certain questions, growls a warning at Pike whenever the question skims too close to their personal lives for Kirk's liking. Pike only casts Kirk an irritated glance, moves on to the next question until McCoy is tapped out and feeling drained. Kirk's beside him instantly, his fingers at the nape of McCoy's neck, rubs the steady pressure that has McCoy's eyes drooping. "We done?" Kirk asks harshly. Pike closes his notebook, tucks his pen into his shirt pocket. "We're done." When Pike is at the door, he turns and faces everyone in the room, stares them all down like he's fearless and bulletproof. "Whatever you plan on doing," he begins, "don't. For once, let this go through the proper channels. We'll get him with his heroin bust. Don't do anything foolish to jeopardize that." "We don't know what you're talking about," Scotty says darkly from the couch, the bandage removed from his neck to reveal the puffy pink skin held together with thick black thread. "No, Montgomery, I didn't expect you would." Pike casts a sad look around the room, ends his gaze on McCoy. He looks apologetic. "You have to stay here," Kirk tells him the next morning. He's getting dressed to head to the courthouse, wears the dark black Marc Jacobs suit and the cream-colored shirt McCoy bought for him. "Stay away from the windows and don't go outside. If you need anything, tell Chekhov." McCoy nods mutely, hasn't said a word since Pike left hours ago. He swallows around the knot in his throat and blocks out the flashes of the nightmare he saw. It's when he starts to think about it, really think, that the numbness sets in, the slapping cold that steals his breath and leaves the bitter, acidic taste of bile in his throat. Hannity had a baby girl, Chloe. Mbenga had a mother in Silver Lake. Ramirez a boyfriend who was going to ask her to marry him next Saturday on her birthday. Nero marched into McCoy's hospital and killed 177 people. 11 of those bodies were from the infirmary. All brand new lives ended with a blade to their tender throats. Those people would still be alive had it not been for him. Had he listened to that voice in his head that told him to stay far away from Kirk and his crew? It only occurs to McCoy later that day that had he been on time, he would have been one of those bodies, that Nero would have put a gun in his mouth and sent Kirk the loudest message he possibly could have. Kirk finds him that night, hunched over the toilet, heaving and coughing and spitting. His throat is so raw and burnt he can't speak, can't even move. Kirk's hushed, low voice coaxes McCoy from the bathroom, guides him to the bed, and hands him a glass of water he gulps down in one go, instantly feels the flood of cool coat the inside of his throat. "Think you can eat?" Kirk asks patiently. McCoy shakes his head and Kirk nods. "It's okay. Try to sleep. I'll be here all night." McCoy turns to his side, feels Kirk slotting beside him, close enough to touch. But Kirk doesn't, gives him all the space he needs. McCoy doesn't want space. He pushes back into Kirk until Kirk's breath is wet against his neck and his chest lined against McCoy's spine. "He was supposed to die yesterday." "I wouldn't have allowed it," Kirk says against the shell of his ear, as if reading his mind. His voice is low and hot and assured, as the day he walked into McCoy's office and told him he was coming home with him. Kirk wraps his arm around McCoy's hips, keeps his palm flat over McCoy's heart, and presses his lips against the pulse. McCoy thinks that right now is the absolute worst time to realize he loves the man. Chekhov ends up as McCoy's babysitter, which is ludicrous enough to make McCoy laugh. He's old enough to have fathered the kid in high school and has no idea what Chekhov's going on about a good portion of the time. Chekhov's English is just about the worst McCoy's ever heard, and he grew up around drunk southerners with accents as thick as molasses, but it doesn't stop the kid from practicing. When he asks, Chekhov tells McCoy about Nero, talks slowly, and uses his hands to animate the words he doesn't quite know. From what McCoy has gathered, Nero was once a member of the family that made an ill-timed power grab. Had every major head of the organization burned the stars off his back with a blowtorch and exiled him from the gang. He went on to gather his own power base, had enough connections with family rivals, and created his own mob, the Romulans. Nero made the call that landed Chekhov's father in prison, killed Kirk's father the day he was awarded a trial to prosecute Nero. For the last 15 years, Nero and the family have been volleying their revenge, have been attacking and pressing forward inch by inch, each side striking the most vulnerable areas of the opposing networks. Like St. James. Like McCoy. When the numbness turns to anger, Kirk stops shielding him, starts including him. Kirk assembles the family in the dining room the next morning, and doesn't look twice when McCoy sits beside Sulu and Spock. He's been locked up in Kirk's mansion for 2 weeks, knows Kirk is just keeping his promise to protect him, to keep him safe. But McCoy doesn't want protection anymore, wants Kirk to promise him he'll make Nero pay that he'll suffer for what he's done. They go over possible plans of attack, possible courses to pursue. Spock immediately takes over, brings out diagrams for warehouses Nero owns, and a manifest for his next drug delivery. Scotty talks about bombs, about fire. Uhura finishes tapping on her BlackBerry and tells on her brothers, "We'll have them armed in 4 days." Kirk stands to the side, takes in everything, and nods. He promises blood, tells them to prepare for war. They fuck for a first time in a week that night. McCoy bowls Kirk over onto the sheets, bites his lips and forces his tongue into Kirk's mouth, sucks filthily on his tongue and ruts his hardening cock along Kirk's thigh, blinded by his own need and want. Kirk tries to keep it slow, rolls McCoy onto his back and softens his kiss, holds McCoy's face maddeningly still in his vice-like grip, and peppers soft, deep kisses along McCoy's face with his swollen hot lips. McCoy keens, bucks, twists like a feral animal, flips Kirk and runs his nails along Kirk's hips, absolutely starving for Kirk's touch. "Jim," he begs, devouring Kirk's mouth and keeps on grinding until Kirk's hands run down his sides and harshly tug at the hem of his t-shirt. Kirk's fingers along his bare skin feel like brands. Burn him in all the right ways. Make him whine and groan and beg for more. Kirk's never denied him anything in bed. Returns McCoy's intensity with his desperation. Flicks his tongue along McCoy's like a whip. Makes his cock throb so painfully. He reaches into his pants and jerks himself just to alleviate the pressure. Kirk shakes his head. Urges McCoy's hands away from around his dick with a few well-placed nips. Rolls his hips acrobatically and keeps their cocks rubbing and sliding against each other through the maddening confines of their clothes. Kirk keeps one hand splayed wide and strung against McCoy's back, keeps their hips aligned, and reaches for the lube. He uncaps the bottle with one hand, yanks at the elastic of McCoy's pajama pants, pulls it right under the curve of his ass and keeps his dick trapped and leaking into the soft cotton, thrusts a slick finger into him and instantly targets his prostate. More! McCoy groans. Pants wetly against Kirk's neck and moans long and drugged when Kirk obliges, pressing back with three fingers, and the burn is so damn good. McCoy's back arches as he wiggles and struggles to keep Kirk's fingers harshly stroking against prostate, working him into a frenzy. Kirk doesn't stop stretching him open, lets McCoy fuck his fingers and rock back into his hand. He curls his fingers into the sheets around Kirk's head, gasps as his oxygen supply begins to dwindle. As Kirk's brows furrow in concentration, as his fingers speed up, his stroking becomes firmer and quicker inside McCoy. When McCoy comes, there's a delay in his orgasm, in the rush in his stomach that simultaneously implodes and explodes, makes him buck and shake like a broken wind-up toy. He feels the crash of his orgasm twice, feels like he's managed to come twice in the span of a second. Hiccups out his low, ragged moan and drops heavily onto Kirk's chest, shakes because his body's neurons are overstimulated and raw. Kirk wraps both arms around his back, slides up and down his shaking spine, shushes him gently, when the tears come and don't stop. Peg calls him to the station, says he needs his signature on his statement and has a few follow-up questions he needs to ask. The hospital massacre has been all the press has been reporting, Kirk somehow keeping McCoy's name out of all the papers, and the city has been pressuring the DA's office for action, been nagging the police for justice. Kirk tells Spock to pull the car around, insists on coming along despite how he's got thick black circles under his eyes, looks as haggard and worn as a fraying rope. McCoy doesn't need a medical degree to see he's exhausted, tells him to stay home and get some sleep. It's a testament to how tired Kirk really is, because he goes without any hesitation, gets Spock to drive with him the 20-odd blocks to the police station. Spock doesn't say anything as he drives, the silence in the car stifling. When they arrive at the police station, Spock waits outside Pike's door. Pike shakes his head disapprovingly when he shuts the door behind him. Pike's office looks like it's straight out of an episode of NYPD Blue. He's got piles of case files covering the corners of his desk, pages of scribbled-on yellow legal paper ripped out and scattered. There's nothing personal in the office, just a thick china mug with a spray of stars around the outside, a mug that resembles the one he had on his desk in his office. Pike notices him staring. A joke from Jim, he explains. His way of starring me. Kids always had a sick sense of humor. You need me to sign something? McCoy deflects. Pike leans back in his chair. You know, I've known Jim his whole life. Pike begins fondly, like a nostalgic grandfather. Was the best man at George's wedding. He and Winnie made me his godfather. McCoy cocks an eyebrow. Needless to say, Doctor, I'm not under any illusions as to what George did in his spare time, what Jim's doing with that Benetton ad of a crew he parades around with him. I helped bury his daddy 7 years ago. I don't want to bury him, too. So, you need me to sign something? McCoy repeats, keeps the surly edge from his tone. Pike gives him a long, even look, sighs. Fine. He opens his desk, pulls out a folder that he slides towards McCoy. Forensics found a significant amount of Arnab Puri's blood in his office and in all the rooms. The directionality of the drops indicate he was most likely carried while bleeding. Peck fixes his blue gaze on him. Puri was working with Nero, wasn't he? McCoy tenses. The dread spreading through his gut becomes tangible. And Jim knew that, didn't he? You think... McCoy's mouth is so numb the words barely spill out. You think Jim did this? No, Pike immediately corrects. I know just as well as you did who's responsible for what happened. To be blunt, Doctor, you were the target and everyone else was collateral damage. Nero didn't get what he wanted, and he's going to come back angrier and meaner. What are you saying? McCoy snaps, feels his pulse speeding beneath his skin. I'm saying that people who don't have their stars and are involved with the family have a bad tendency to turn up dead or missing. His hard gaze lands firmly on McCoy, regardless of who they're fucking. McCoy balls his fist so tightly around the pen in his fingers, the tubing cracks. He quickly scribbles his name on the dotted line of his statement and marches out of the office. Spock's silence makes the car unbearable. They're almost at the mansion, back to the place McCoy has been calling home for the better half of a year, to a place that feels more like a home than the spacious two-bedroom above a bakery and the house he left in Georgia. For the first time since he got caught in the crossfire of a decade-long mob war, McCoy feels like the walls of his life are pressing against him, suffocating him from all angles. He needs oxygen in the car, can't handle the recycled, chilled air of the air conditioner, comes close to hyperventilating. Spock casts a long, elegant eyebrow in McCoy's direction before his eyes flicker back to the road. Doctor, he begins in his neutral, cultured voice, I'm aware of the predicament you... And that's all Spock manages to get out before four loud booms have the car lurching forward, the back end swerving dangerously, and McCoy and Spock ricochet like coins in a tin can. McCoy's head smashes against his window hard enough to crack the glass. The airbags deploy when the car veers into a streetlight, the impact so sudden and hard McCoy feels his nose snap, the force like a kick to the face. He moans, feels Spock's hand on his arm before he stiffly and blindly reaches for the gun at his hip. McCoy can hear footsteps rushing towards them, a frantic, hurried stampede. The side of his door is lurched open and the seatbelt cut away from his body with a knife that cuts into his chest. Spock, he groggily calls out when he's hoisted out of the car. Blearily, a tall, bald man with jagged facial scars and tattoos and features chiseled out of smooth marble march over to the driver's side window and fires his gun three times in rapid succession. McCoy sees a spray of red angled against the blinding white airbag, calls out Spock's name and has the butt of a gun slammed against his temple, and sends him into darkness. Part 5. When McCoy wakes up, his vision is a fractured, fuzzy thing. His mouth is filled with the taste of blood, and his head throbs like fire. There are fingers gently combing through his hair, his head pooled on a warm lap. Jim, he groggily whimpers, his limbs too sluggish and heavy for a mere concussion. He swallows past the strong copper blood in his mouth and tastes the bitter residue of medication. The fingers stroking through his hair immediately stop, a calloused, rough thumb swiping along his bottom lip. Shh, the voice above him hushes, the fingers in his hair resuming their petting. McCoy squirms away from the hands, panic and fear roiling through his gut like nausea, the acid and bile pressing against the back of his throat. McCoy tries to weakly prop himself up, struggles against his numb, drugged limbs, and feels the prick of a needle slide into his neck, hears the low, disappointed tsks of a man holding him down, and promptly drops off with the feel of a stranger's hand in his hair and fingers against his lips. The first thing he becomes conscious of is the cold. Wherever he is, it's absolutely freezing, the surface under his cheek frigid and hard like chipped cement. The smell comes next, a decaying, meaty smell that reminds McCoy of the farm his grandparents owned. His arms are tightly bound behind his back, his shoulders pulled up to the brink of dislocation, his legs unbound where the drug still churns in his system, robs him of his motion. All he can taste is the bitter taste of the drugs, the thick, cottony feel of grime coating his tongue like syrup. McCoy tries to move, is rewarded with a sharp bolt of pain that cuts across his spine, stops him dead in his tracks as his cloudy brain struggles to process the agony in his limbs. He lets out a sloppy grunt of pain, takes a deep breath to clear his mind. That's good, Leonard. Highly polished Italian loafers appear in front of McCoy's eyeline. Struggling will only make this worse. The foot in question swiftly kicks McCoy in the chest, right in the solar plexus, and the oxygen in McCoy's body exits his body in one sharp motion, his entire body rolling onto his back and applying the worst pressure imaginable onto his shoulder blades. McCoy's cry of pain rips through his throat, makes him pant and suck in gulps of air that burn his lungs like acid. When McCoy's vision stops dancing, he's left staring up at the long, broad body of Nero. Nero crouches until his face is close enough to see in the dim light of the freezing room, his breath coming out in little white puffs. He'd be handsome, if not for the violent scars on his cheek and head, the crumpled wrinkles of badly healed burned skin. The tattoos on his face look like the ones running up Spock's neck. And the memory of three quick gunshots and a splash of red makes the nausea in McCoy's stomach boil. "I want you to know," Nero begins, his voice soothing and lulling, the barest trace of a lisp McCoy would bet his medical license is due to a poorly set mandible fracture. "This isn't about you." Nero pets McCoy's hair again, looks sympathetic. When Nero speaks, his voice is dark and cruel. "But this is about James. I'm sorry to say, Leonard, but he's not going to find you. There won't be some last-minute heroic rescue. You're going to die right here in this room, and there's not a single thing James can do to stop me." McCoy swallows, the fear twisting his guts into knots. "But we're going to have a little fun first." Nero snaps his fingers, and two new sets of hands dig into his shoulders and tuck him up, dragging by the thick rope coiled around his torso that digs into his skin. The men pull McCoy across the room, past the hanging, skinned carcasses of dead cows. He's in a slaughterhouse. The goons suddenly stop and drop McCoy like a sack of flour. McCoy hears the rattle of heavy chains, hears a heavy thump of skin and bones connecting with the floor. When McCoy tilts his head, his blurred eyes immediately focus on the bloating, rotted body of Arnab Pori. McCoy gasps, sees the gouges where his pale, mocha-colored eyes should be, the maggot-coated stump where his tongue was cut away, the two rips along his cheeks that remind him of Scotty, and the thin scars that now remain. Pori had been savagely beaten, his skull caved in, his fingers peppering the floor like New Year's confetti the next morning, the stump of his right hand crawling with insects. McCoy comes close to throwing up, gags instead, before he's hoisted upwards. Nero's men slot a thick meat hook behind his arms, yank on a chain that lifts McCoy straight off the ground, and the pain in his arms and upper chest is strong enough to make him woozy. "Ael?" Nero motions to the smaller of the two thugs. Ael shifts the hook, and the pressure suddenly vanishes. Instead, leaves McCoy dangling like a guppy. "I hope you last longer than he did," Aya whispers maliciously into McCoy's ear, chuckles as he kicks Pori's corpse out of the way. McCoy wants to call out, but the sharp prick of a needle digging into his soft tissue has him dropping off into an unconscious haze. They leave McCoy hanging for 2 days. McCoy's stomach snarls and groans thunderously, his thirst unbearable. He swallows reflexively, the walls of his parched throat rubbing against each other like sandpaper. He's delirious, I'm starving, and the cold and smell of the slaughterhouse have made him sick twice. The chill seeping through the light fabric of his shirt has been keeping his limbs mercifully numb. On the eve of the second day, Nero comes back. He has a sweating bottle of water clutched in his hand, a concerned look on his face. Aiel is behind him, moves toward the contraption holding the chains in place, and when Nero nods, he kicks at the lever. McCoy drops, lands on his knees, and cries out when the pain splinters in his legs and radiates to his skull. Nero walks towards him, wipes McCoy's mouth with his neatly folded pocket square, and holds the bottle to McCoy's lips. McCoy nearly keens, swallows until the bottle is empty. Nero circles him, keeps his lips close to the shell of McCoy's ear, his voice hushed and gentle. McCoy hates how he squirms into the heat of Nero's body, how even this momentary reprieve from complete rigidity calms his revolting imagination. "James isn't happy," Nero begins, pressing his forehead against McCoy's temple. "I imagine I'd be furious, too, if someone took away my pretty bed warmer." Without looking away from McCoy, Aiel hands Nero a long, serrated blade that Nero uses to hack through the ropes. Doesn't stop until every last one lay around McCoy like cut ribbons. McCoy's shoulders curl in on themselves, attempting to regain some of the mobility, alleviate the stiffness. Nero rubs his back, hums approvingly when McCoy shakes. McCoy feels the tip of the blade skim down his spine. He freezes comically as Nero slides the serrated points under his shirt, twists his wrists gracefully, and slices through the fabric in one long motion. Nero hums in appreciation, drags the cool tips of his fingers down McCoy's back. I want my drugs, Leonard, Nero says conversationally. He uses the knife to saw through his belt and the seat of his pants. McCoy flinches, tries to scramble away when the tip of the blade comes in contact with his ass. Nero holds him down, growls menacingly. The knife slides into McCoy's left leg, the fabric falling apart easily under the sharp bite of metal. When Nero's got him naked and trembling, he glides the smooth side of the knife under his cock, makes McCoy whimper. I wonder what part of you I should send James. Wonder how many chunks of your body it'll take to get him to give me back what's mine. McCoy squeezes his eyes shut at Nero's words, swallows his terror. Do you think you're important enough, Leonard? Go to hell, he hisses between clenched teeth. Nero laughs, withdraws his knife, and pulls McCoy's paralyzed left hand to his mouth. Which one do I send him first? He kisses each digit, slips McCoy's numb fingers into his mouth one at a time, sucks lightly, and makes McCoy's skin crawl. Nero repeats the process with McCoy's right hand, McCoy's empty stomach threatening to lurch upward in disgust. They're all so delicious, Nero sighs theatrically. I can't decide. McCoy suddenly finds himself being propelled forward, his body connecting with the rough, filthy ground and his head bouncing harshly against the concrete. Nero harshly climbs onto his back, grabs both of McCoy's wrists in his hands, and leans in close to his ear. Maybe I should send the whole hand. The serrated edges are pressed into McCoy's skin, draw blood. McCoy's entire body jerks, bucks, and twists, and he manages to catch Nero in the nose with his left elbow, has him drawing back and snarling out a curse. Nero's fist, when it connects, causes bright bursts of color to explode behind McCoy's eyes, has him seeing triple. Nero grabs McCoy's left arm and twists sharply behind his back. McCoy screams. Nero keeps applying a curling, agonizing force, and McCoy hisses and screams and feels all of the tendons and muscles ripping, actually feels the exact second the bone caves against the pressure and snaps. McCoy lets out a piercing howl, and Nero slams his face into the pavement. Nero brings McCoy food on the fourth day. He props McCoy up while he feeds him out of his hand, makes the humiliation sink into McCoy's gut in a fester. Nero thankfully never draws out their mealtime longer than he has to, pushes piece after piece of thinly cubed food past McCoy's lips, only starts to let his fingers linger on McCoy's mouth 6 days in. The way Nero begins to touch him, with bold, purposeful touches, brings the darkness a little closer. Every time Nero takes a damp cloth to his skin and spends far too long rubbing away the dirt from his thighs and chest, McCoy begins to forget what Kirk's hands felt like, forgets how human touch didn't revolt and sicken him to his core. They don't bother stringing him up anymore. Instead, they leave him sprawled on the floor. Ayel sticks him with a needle, always jabs too close to the muscle, and the drugs make McCoy pliant and still. McCoy knows they're injecting him too often, can feel the hold of the drugs weakening every day. McCoy begins to notice the larger doses Ayel uses, as his body grows a tolerance. If this keeps up much longer, McCoy is not going to have to worry about being tortured to death. He'll have his liver shut down instead. Nero always arrives after the drug has had hours to circulate through him. McCoy's broken ulna still throbs like fire beneath his skin, the splintered bones rubbing with every minor jolt. Nero tuts his muffled groans, rolls him onto his back, and pushes his dirty, greasy hair from his eyes. Would you believe, Nero begins, amused, that James broke into Christopher's station and got me my drugs? He doesn't let McCoy even open his mouth before he continues. He sent me back $4 million worth of uncut Bolivian heroin. It's right then, on the seventh day of his capture, that Nero orders Ayel out of the room. For the first time in 7 days, McCoy doesn't want Ayel gone. Nero's rough, blunt fingers cup his ass, squeeze purposefully. So, let's see what all the fuss is about. The knife is small, smooth, and razor sharp like a scalpel. Nero twirls the blade between his fingers expertly, lets the tiny streams of light in the room reflect its shiny, clean edge. He keeps on twirling, doesn't give any inclination to stop, stares at McCoy with a deep furrow of concentration marring his brow. After a while, Nero flips the knife into his hand, crouches down, and runs his palm possessively along McCoy's back. McCoy flinches against a touch, tries to turn his head to look away. You know what this is, right? Nero taps McCoy's nose with the blade, lets him get a closer look. Nero's smile twists his tattooed face and McCoy's eyes flicker in recognition. It's a 22 surgical grade blade. And this? He produces a large squeeze tube and turns over the label so McCoy can read. McCoy's heart stops for a fraction of a second. A Surgiseal. Nero somehow got his hands on medical glue. The pieces click into place and McCoy pushes past the perpetual nauseous state he's been in since the car accident, past the black and purple swelling of his arm, and tries to jumpstart his body, tries to escape. Nero smirks against the back of McCoy's neck. He bites down on the freckles Kirk has spent almost a year tasting under his tongue. The thought of Kirk and his welcome warm touches makes McCoy sick right then and there. He coughs up the paltry portions of food Nero's been giving him, splutters at the vomit, and chokes. Nero ignores his mess, straddles his hips and grinds his palm against McCoy's head, keeps his face smashed uncomfortably against the cement. "Don't you dare move," Nero growls darkly. His tone promises more pain than McCoy has experienced in this hellhole, and the fear keeps McCoy still, even as Nero takes the knife to his back. Nero cuts a long, curving line across McCoy's shoulder. McCoy squeezes his eyes shut, grits his teeth while Nero slices haphazardly, like he's using the scalpel blade like a paintbrush. After Nero pulls the blade from McCoy's back, he squeezes out a glob of the Surgiseal to glue the wounds back together, holds McCoy's flesh together long enough for the sealant to take and scar unevenly. "James never gave you stars," Nero says after the 16th cut, after the pain and the blood loss have McCoy fading in and out of consciousness. "Saves me having to cut them out, I suppose." Nero digs the knife into McCoy's soft tissue when he doesn't respond. Makes him scream. "It's okay," Nero coaxes, runs his hands through the blood and the glue, across the stinging, throbbing lines, the odd patterns being carved into him. "You don't wear his mark, but you'll wear mine forever." Nero does a piss-poor job of wrapping the injuries to McCoy's back, uses elastic wrap instead of gauze, and lets him sit in his crusted, flaky blood for a whole day. When Nero comes back, he peels away the wrap and looks at his masterpiece, licks his lips and resists touching. McCoy's certain he's been missing for half a month. It was easier to count the passing of days when he was in the main slaughterhouse, had the windows, but Nero moved him to a cramped, windowless office where he lay sprawled out on a thick oak desk. McCoy tries to count the number of times Nero will pop in with the news on Kirk and the family. Always sneers like their efforts are the funniest jokes he's ever heard. Isle visits less and less. His company no great loss. But there are stretches of hours between the needle that numbs his limbs and rots his liver, and Nero's spiteful cackle of laughter, that McCoy wonders if Kirk will ever find him, tucked away in some slaughterhouse office in God knows what state. Every morning McCoy wakes up from his drug-induced slumber, and wonders if today is the day Nero and his men are going to hack into him like they did Pori, if they're going to turn him into another putrefied corpse left to rot between a molding cow flank and a brick wall. McCoy wonders if Kirk's looking in the right direction, even looking at all anymore. After 15 days of waiting for the impending touch of death, McCoy begins to fear that Nero will keep him alive. On day 16, McCoy's worries are put to rest. Nero's rage is a palpable creature, emanates from his eyes and mouth and fists and stride. He slams the door to the office shut, runs towards McCoy and lashes out with his highly polished Italian loafers, gets McCoy square in the gut. Dread explodes in McCoy's gut like a time bomb that just hits zero. "Kirk and his fucking crew killed Aiel," Nero barks. His anger is almost beautiful, brings all his tattoos together in a swirling sharp arc. He kicks McCoy again in the stomach, lands quicker, harder blows to the ribs like he's trying to crack through to McCoy's chest. Nero's fists join in, slam into McCoy's cheeks and nose, land on his temple and jaw and make the pain wash through his body like a wave of relief. When Nero drops to his knees, he gets the leverage he needs to really lay into McCoy, drives his knuckles into McCoy's sternum over and over until McCoy's lungs feel bruised in his ribcage, until unconsciousness tries to comfortingly take over. Nero keeps him conscious, beats McCoy's face until McCoy is sure one more blow will collapse his skull. Nero's going to kill him, just like how he was supposed to a month ago, except instead of the familiar hospital surrounded by the dead bodies of his friends, it's in a non-functioning slaughterhouse that perpetually smells like raw meat and old blood. McCoy stopped trying to avoid the inevitable when he met Kirk. Knows this demise is messier than the one he always imagined, but no less painful. Nero's fingers dig into McCoy's throat, his grip tighter than a vice, his thumbs crushing McCoy's larynx, stopping the pitiful gulps of air McCoy has been sucking in through his broken nose. Nero squeezes harder, seethes and spits and curses with promises of cutting McCoy up into so many pieces Kirk will never be able to find them all. Darkness swirls in McCoy's vision, blanks his mind. There's a series of loud popping sounds somewhere in the distance, like the engine of a tractor kick-starting at dawn. A few moments later, Nero's hands around his throat are gone, and the pulverized flesh of his body stops pounding so prevalently. McCoy can feel his heart slowing down, waving a slow goodbye. There's a gentle pressure on his split lips, followed by a rush of air so powerful that it forces its way into McCoy's lungs and has him choking for more oxygen and blinking open his swollen, aching eyes. All McCoy sees is a flood of bright blue before absolutely nothing. There's a familiar, comforting smell to hospitals that McCoy has always appreciated. It's the bleach and the antiseptic alcohol, the smell of absolute clean, of perfect sterility. McCoy's smelled nothing but raw beef for the last 15 days, immediately knows he's no longer in the slaughterhouse, and nearly cries in relief. The heart monitor he's hooked up to spikes slightly, the sound so beautiful to McCoy's ears that for a second it's too overwhelming, crushes his chest and makes his next breath hitch a pained gasp. The swelling in McCoy's face is blissfully decreased, his limbs twitching and moving when he commands them to, his left arm weighed down by heavy plaster of Paris and a blue protective mesh. McCoy hadn't noticed it at first, but there are fingers gently resting on the ones peeking through the cast. Kirk's hunched over his bed in one of the plastic Art Deco chairs from the waiting room, his blonde head resting on the crook of his arms. McCoy looks at the clock on the wall, sees that it's past 2 a.m. He casts a quick, suddenly exhausted gaze at the monitor hooked up to his body, tries to make out the reading, but sleep overtakes him, and he drops off like a light to the comforting hums and beeps of machinery. He wakes to Kirk's lips against his forehead, makes a soft sound when Kirk pulls away. Kirk's joy is like a battering ram, hits McCoy square in the torso and chases away all the nightmares. Leaves behind a bright, warm feeling that McCoy had locked away that first night Nero shot out the tires and... Spock! His voice is ragged, sore. Kirk has both his hands on McCoy's face, presses their foreheads together. He's fine, Kirk reassures. He was shot in the chest and head, but the bastard's fine, has Uhura doting on him night and day. Kirk's smile is crooked, playful. McCoy's missed him so damn much, he's surprised he could even breathe being away from him. How'd you find me? McCoy croaks, as Kirk tips a cold glass of water against his lips. Kirk waits for him to finish, pushes away his long, cowlicked hair, and tells him about Nero offering McCoy for his drugs. How Kirk went to Pike and made a deal, how when Nero reneged on their trade, Kirk tore through every known affiliate of the Romulans and bled them for answers. How he made it all the way to Nero's second-in-command, and let Chekhov and Sulu and Scotty have their way with him before he sang. Pike let the family run rampant. McCoy wants to know what Kirk promised in exchange. Kirk doesn't look him in the eyes. When he tells McCoy that Nero is still alive, McCoy feels like he's trapped right back in that slaughterhouse. McCoy gets his hands on his medical charts, is calmed when he sees the stats on his liver. How the damage the drugs caused had been flushed from his system on a strong concoction of broad-spectrum antibiotics. They had to reset his arm, but the lacerations and bruises are already starting to scab and brown. He gets Kirk to help him off the bed, his legs still like jelly, and heads to the small bathroom, makes Kirk untie the knots of his hospital scrubs, peel away the fluffy gauze circling his torso. When Kirk sees the cuts, the badly closed wounds that are going to scar in thick lines. He curses so viciously that he almost forgets he's the only thing keeping McCoy propped up. "What's it say?" McCoy asks, buries his head in the crook of Kirk's neck. "It's a message for me," Kirk seethes. He wraps his arm around McCoy without hesitating, pulls him closer. It doesn't matter. We'll get rid of it, I promise. McCoy sneaks a look when Kirk's refastening the cords, sees amongst the Romulan gang markings the thicker, redder outline of stars, with Nero's names etched along his spine. The humiliation burns worse than the anger and the helplessness. Kirk stays with him at nights, destroys his posture slumped over the side of McCoy's hospital bed, unwilling to break the hold he's had on him since he was wheeled into the Colorado Trauma Center 3 days prior. In the end, it's a nurse that accidentally lets slip Nero is in the same hospital, apparently took almost a full clip of bullets to the major joints of every limb, is in the CC unit. McCoy is not sure how he manages to detangle Kirk's fingers from his own, how he's able to slide himself off the bed and stand on his own 2 feet, but he shuffles achingly slowly past Kirk, past the nurses and doctors making their late-night rounds, and stops in front of the only critical care room with a shut door and a chair outside it. The guard has to be in the cafeteria, at a vending machine, but McCoy doesn't stop to think about that, keeps moving forward until he's pushed past the door and walks in on a heavily medicated Nero. McCoy instantly stares at the morphine IV, the drip set to the lowest setting to offshoot a reaction to the two other banana bags hanging on Nero's pole. McCoy's been a doctor for the last 10 years of his life, knows his way around the equipment and the lines, as well as he knows his own name. When he reaches for the drip, he twists the nozzle without remorse, let loose a flood of morphine that rushes down the line straight into Nero's veins. Nero almost immediately begins to sweat, his skin turning blue from the cold. McCoy wishes Nero was conscious so he could feel the fluid building up in his lungs, the fluid that's going to suffocate him exactly the way he tried to suffocate McCoy. Strong arms coil around McCoy's waist unexpectedly. Kirk's hand reaches past McCoy and stems the drip, leaves the valve open just enough to look like an accident, and tells McCoy to move. Kirk half carries McCoy out of Nero's room before the guard has returned, and gets McCoy back in his bed just as a wild flash of doctors and nurses rush past their door, the code blue beeping on pagers everywhere. McCoy's release papers are signed the next morning, as Nero's body is carted off to the morgue. The official cause of death is an accidental drug overdose that Pike doesn't believe for a second. But the phone call Kirk put in to Scotty and Chekhov took care of all the security cameras in the hospital in less than an hour. McCoy sits outside his room as his bed is stripped, as Kirk deals with his attending doctor. Despite the uncomfortable pull of fresh scabs along his back, McCoy hunches over himself, rests his puffy face against the hard plaster of his hand, and tries to let the severity of the situation sink into his head. Thinks about what he's done. Kirk's steady gait walks towards him, hesitates for a fraction of a second, before he sits beside McCoy, his knees close enough to touch. Kirk reaches into his pocket and pulls out his lighter, his pack of cigarettes, and lights one despite the copious number of signs that tell him he can't. No one will stop him, even if they do see him. "So," Kirk begins, blows out a heavy huff of smoke. "About last night." "Jim," he warns, weary and so sick of making excuses. "Here." Kirk offers McCoy his pack with a reassuring, serene smile on his handsome face. McCoy knows those cigarettes are flown in from France, intimately knows how the nicotine tastes on his tongue, on Kirk's tongue. He wants, sudden and primal, and takes. Kirk leans forward, his two blue eyes never once leaving McCoy's face, as he smiles brilliantly around the cigarette in his mouth, sucks in and lets the embers flare hot enough for McCoy to light his own. "Thanks," McCoy says softly, feels the shakes in his hands stopping even before he's swallowed his first lungful of tobacco. "It'll be all right." Kirk leans back, grins. "You're family now." The end.